Hello, you're listening to New England Climate Conversations, the podcast all about the impacts of climate change and how we can make a difference. I'm your host, Owen, and I'm joined by my co-hosts, Dean, Luna, and Corbin. On this episode, we'll be talking about the relationship between climate change and indoor air quality, mold and pollen, and wind turbines. But first, let's get into the weekly Climate Bites, our rapid-fire segment about recent major climate events. I'll turn it over to Luna to start.
Wildfires striking the Chilean areas of Viña del Mar and Quilpué resulted in the loss of over 131 lives and many more missing earlier this winter. In the recent decades, these wildfires have been the worst disaster in the immediate region since the 2010 earthquake. High temperatures and extreme drought sparked severe wildfires. 14,000 houses were effectively destroyed or greatly damaged, leaving thousands more displaced. The wildfires required a response of 31 aircraft and 1,400 individuals. The loss of Viña del Mar's Botanical Garden underscores the loss of biodiversity and cultural damage that climate change has had on the region.
An oil spill of 420,000 gallons, 1.6 million liters, caused Trinidad and Tobago to declare a national emergency. The oil spill was first noticed by Trinidad and Tobago Coast Guard on February 7th and was traced back to the barge capsized by a reef 150 meters, 500 feet, off of Tobago's southern coast. No crew was found on the barge and no distress signal seemed to have been sent. Bonaire is a Caribbean island located more than 100 miles away, which has stated that the oil has reached its shores, causing human and environmental harm and an increased risk for reef and ocean ecosystems. The chief secretary of the Tobagan House of Assembly warned that a spill of this size could take up to 8 months to clean.
So this winter in Maine, I mean, and as I say this, we're getting a bit of a spring snow flurry right now, with the forecast predicting 3 to 8 inches, although that most likely won't happen. This winter has seen very little snow and some unusual severe weather events. Well, there have been no huge ice or snowstorms, which are quite characteristics of winters past in Maine. There have been several major rain events, many moderate ones, and seemingly much milder temperatures than usual, with only a handful of nights reaching single digits or going below in Fahrenheit, as well as a hurricane, Hurricane Lee, back around December.
Flooding has been the most prolific global disaster this year, with flooding occurring in several countries across the globe in 2024, in addition to regional floods. The countries most affected include Mongolia, Bolivia, Brazil, Ecuador, and the Marshall Islands, in addition to some unusually heavy storms and rain in the United Arab Emirates that may yet lead to flooding.
Climate change is expected to worsen our air quality. The number of pollutants that get exhausted into our air, like pollens and fossil fuel fumes, are harming the ground-level ozone, which is the ozone level we breathe through. Ozone gas on the ground level can cause serious health problems as it attacks the lungs and reacts to it on a chemical level. To give a quote visual representation, ozone gas is the main part of smog, the fun nasty fog/smoke we get over large cities and industrial sites. Breathing in ozone gas can cause immediate or in a relatively brief time shortness of breath, coughing, wheezing, asthma attacks, increased risk of respiratory infection, increased risk of pulmonary infection, and increases the need for people with pre-existing lung diseases to receive medical treatment from hospitals. Long-term effects of breathing in ozone gases can cause metabolic nervous system issues and reproductive issues, cancer, and cardiovascular diseases. The more climate change we experience in the world, the worse our air quality is becoming. The increasing number of warm days adds to the total number of air pollutants and allergens that are released through the air. To top that off with already affected lung health, and we have a perfect recipe for disaster. As the air quality outside our homes worsens, we can also count on it to influence our indoor air quality. Pollutants can enter a home through doors, windows, and vents, which can cause things such as mold, mites, and bacteria, which further affect the indoor air quality. Warmer days related to climate change means longer warm seasons, which means we have a longer pollen season, leaving an airborne allergen active for a longer period than we are used to. So we are looking at a longer allergic reaction and an increase to the sensitivity to pollen. We can also see an increase in those affected by asthma and see more severity in asthma attacks that we do not usually see today. It has already been touched on, but wildfires are something that we will probably see more of in the future with the ever-warming days. Smoke from wildfires are pollutant and it is not safe for us to breathe. Wildfire smoke can cause respiratory issues like asthma and COPD. Air quality indoors and outdoors can influence the economy because without a good air quality, it is seen that productivity in work and in school decreases. Poor indoor air quality has been noted to cause an impairment of cognitive functions. Poor indoor air quality has also been linked to something called sick building syndrome, SBS, which has symptoms such as headaches, fatigue, and cold/flu-like symptoms. Stress and distractions are seen in higher levels in workplaces and schools that have poor indoor air quality. The economy could also see an increase in healthcare expenses and a decrease in tourism. Air quality can be also affect the ecosystem and the agriculture by making it harder for good yields and the survivability of said yields. Air quality also affects the growth rate of plants by making it more difficult for them to grow properly. Land-based ecosystems are the most affected by air quality. The worst case of a notable decrease in air quality was the Donora smog, which occurred October of 1948 in Pennsylvania. The Donora smog killed 26 people and caused respiratory issues in 6,000 people out of the 14,000 total residents, and to this day is considered the worst air pollutant incident in the world. So what can we do to combat air pollutant and improve our air quality? Well, there's a couple things. We could cut down on our gas and vehicle usage to cut back on the harmful emissions sent out into the air and instead ride a bike, electric scooter, or something other than a fossil fuel burner. Keep your car repaired and maintained can help make sure you are not giving off more emissions than you should. Some people burn their trash as opposed to bring it to the proper facilities to have it taken care of. It should be obvious that burning trash is going to burn and release harmful or dangerous emissions into our air. The biggest thing we can do to help ourselves is to plant and care for trees in the environment. A happy environment equals a happy, healthy life. Next, I'll pass it on to Dean for a piece on mold and pollen.
Thanks, Corbin. So, good day to everybody. I apologize for my voice today. I'm a bit under the weather and masked up. Usually I don't get sick very often, but this spring has been a bit of a doozy. Maybe it's related to what I'm going to be talking about today. Mold, pollen, a bit of moisture, and how climate change affects all of it. So climate change has many impacts on our life that are, perhaps, quite obvious. Weather changes, seasons being shorter or longer, increased number of natural disasters, impact on agriculture. These things are well known, studied, and even quite sensible if you think about it. But what about indoor air quality? And specifically, does climate change make two of the biggest opponents to good indoor air quality and healthy breathing everywhere, mold and pollen, worse, or does it not impact it in a significant way? Well, as it turns out, it does. According to the EPA, 100 million plus Americans already live with poor indoor air quality, and climate change is making it worse. Climate change is increasing ground-level ozone and particulate concentrations, which already reduces air quality. As far as mold, as well as dust, pollen, or really anything similar, the EPA notes that these, quote, may increase as climate change-related storms and precipitation increase, which, of course, they will. The example given is that floods and increased dampness can lead to increased mold growth, and this is very true. The only things mold needs to grow are the right temperature, moisture, and organic material. In addition, mold and other types of fungal expansion have more room to grow due to increased temperatures, increasing the habitability range for such organisms. For example, the fungus that causes valley fever, was historically only documented in hot and dry regions such as Mexico, southwestern U.S., California, those places, but as of 2015 was documented as far north as in Washington. And this sort of spread will only continue. 2015 was the most recent data, by the way. The spread is only going to continue, especially when one considers that also due to climate change, springs and summers are becoming warmer and longer, whereas winter is becoming shorter, my apologies. This last point is key. Much like how the shorter winters leads to an increased tick population, a topic we touched on in a previous episode, these shorter winters also provide more ideal environments for fungus and pollen to spread in. In the same vein as this, the increased heat, according to the CDC, can cause the effective operating heat of fungi to increase with warming temperatures, increasing not only the proliferation of such organisms, but decreasing human resistance to them. In fact, this is alluded to in popular culture in the opening episode of The Last of Us, whereby a scientist makes the same climate-related observation. An additional aggravating factor in all of this, In a similar vein to how bacteria become resistant to certain antibiotics through overuse, is that the increase in fungicide and other pesticides, which themselves have increased in use due to the effects of climate change, may cause fungus themselves to become resistant, further compounding the previous issues. And we actually have an episode about this as well, the impact of climate change on agricultural practices, so check it out. Anyway, as far as pollen, it functions with climate change in a very similar manner to mold and fungi. I explained earlier how warmer and longer seasons increases the proliferation of pollen and fungi spores due to increased time and area in which they can survive. Pollen is no different. The EPA has confirmed that pollen seasons are starting earlier, with ragweed blooms, which produce aggravating pollen, coming sooner, lasting longer, and having an overall increased impact in 10 of the 11 sites that the EPA studied. In addition, NIFA, which stands for the National Institute of Food and Agriculture, which is a part of the USDA, has also conducted recent studies showing that since 1990, pollen seasons start 20 days earlier, last 10 days longer, and contain 21% more pollen, further confirming with hard data what everyone already knew. So, what does all of this mean? Well, like I said, we know that increased CO2 concentration, more wildfires, increase in ground-level ozone, and increased particulate matter, all side effects of anthropogenic climate change, cause poor health effects. But while it may be obvious after the data and arguments have been made, this is yet another one of those hidden effects of climate change that may not have been immediately obvious, or what everyone immediately thought of, when climate change first became a big part of the public discourse, a couple decades ago. But it's here now, and unfortunately, like with everything else in climate change, it's here to stay. The allergy season, like the agricultural situation and the ocean currents, are being negatively impacted by climate change. Just one more reason to increase the urgency at which we're fighting this problem.
Those of us who wonder how to power our industries also ponder how even so-called alternative energy set to displace fossil fuels are impacting economy and ecology. With talks of climate change adaptation and resiliency, as opposed to mitigation, getting heated, many of those disputes are taking place in coastal areas in particular. Wind turbines are hotly contested. In this episode of New England Climate Conversations, I will follow the trajectory of Maine wind-powered energy projects and the stakeholders who have interest in either camp. Lobbying from industry interests are often successful in blocking wind power developments in the New England region. In October, the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management released an updated draft map of potential wind power development areas. Compared to the one released earlier in the year, the area highlighted to be ideal for wind turbine projects shrunk by about two-thirds. This map excludes Lobster Management Area 1, a regional lobster industry. Concerned groups, including ecological nonprofits and lobstermen, lobbied against offshore wind turbine developments. A technology termed floating turbine technology is the primary target of the opposition. Floating wind turbines are attached to a buoyant base, which then anchors to the ocean floor. Contrast that with fixed turbines, in which those of the aquatic type and belong in shallow waters, normally less than 197 feet. Floating wind turbines are more suited to water depths over 197 feet. So how does it work, and what are the downsides? Let's start off with the massive scale of these turbines. The blades are almost 800 feet in diameter. The turbine itself, base and tethering system not included, are over 800 feet tall. How much power does one of these turbines of this class usually generate? A wind turbine like the one set to be installed in the Gulf of Maine about 20 south of the tiny Monhegan Island generated about 17 megawatts, enough to power thousands of homes. An array of almost a dozen of these turbines can produce up to 150 megawatts of wind-generated energy. Most of these deepwater turbines are near Europa. How many of these turbines are needed to meet the nation's energy demand? U.S. Energy Secretary Jennifer Granholm says that a robust set of floating turbines can supply 2.8 terawatts of energy, more than double the nation's demand. Most offshore wind turbines are the sturdy foundation type. Treading into deeper waters requires floating turbines. The average property owner is concerned with the aesthetics impact of turbine arrays have, with many saying that the iconic three-way towers impact the views of the ocean. These concerns have stalled or stopped a large number of wind turbine projects. The Gulf of Maine is a target for developers because of its high average offshore wind speed compared to farther down the coast. Here are some of the perspectives of those who oppose the project, like the one I previously mentioned. Many residents and business owners are bothered by the aesthetics of massive turbines and those classic Maine coastal views. Aesthetics are not trivial. In the coming years, there will be more research coming concerning the footprint and waste of these turbines. They still require resources, and we are just now seeing how the decommission and disposal of turbine parts affects the environment. Offshore wind farms need to be able to withstand harsh waves and turbulent winds, making a stable, steady wind turbine array a difficult and cost expense to build and maintain. They also depreciate property values, as per my point above concerning resident and visitor debate. Now hear what proponents say. Offshore wind farms tend to experience faster wind speeds. Furthermore, the winds are steady, ergo a more steady power supply. The land usage doesn't compare quite like the land usage needed for terrestrial wind turbines. Maine proponents identify the need for economic flexibility and growth with the proliferation of this industry. The University of Maine has produced some research and technologies for the benefit of wind turbine projects, as Maine has identified the need for younger talent, which is latent within the current university system. Searsport is being eyed for the base of offshore wind turbine production. Maine currently has a goal of 80% electricity having a renewable energy resource provenance. This is set to be achieved ideally by 2030, which the state has not projected to meet. Like with right whale conservation, proponents must contend with lobstering interests. On forthcoming episodes of New England Climate Conversations, we will explore the tensions between energy projects, conservation efforts, and resident interests across other themes. Thanks for tuning in.
That's all for this week's episode. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review on your favorite social media platform and share it with your friends. Thank you to everyone who's tuned in to our podcast. This is New England Climate Conversations, signing off.